is Stephanie Rubel from the Stanford Alumni Association. I'd like to welcome our listeners to our sixth and final book of the 2014-2015 Book Salon season, The Extreme Life of the Sea. This month, I'm sitting down with our author and host, Professor Steve Palumbi. Steve is a Stanford parent of an 06 and a 2010 grad, and is the director of the Hopkins Marine Station, which is located just about an hour and a half drive away from the farm in Pacific Grove, California. He is the Harold A. Miller Professor in Marine Sciences, the Jane and Marshall Steele Jr. Professor of Marine Sciences, and a senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment. Steve teaches and researches evolution and marine biology, and his interests range from the evolution and genetics of sea urchins, whales, and corals to the influences of climate change on ocean species. Thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with me today, Steve.
Stephanie, it's a pleasure.
Great. So can you talk to us about what encouraged you and your son Anthony to write this book?
Yeah, you know, Tony and I decided to sit and write this book, The Extreme Life of the Sea, because we really wanted to see what we could do to kick environmental writing into an entirely new level. You know, environmental writing is very important, but people get a little dragged down by it. But we wanted to see whether, all right, could we actually, by combining the skills of a novelist, Tony is a novelist and a scientist, to inject scenery and color and action and character and plot in the environmental writing to make it something that would not only, you know, be very informative about what was going on in the world, but actually fun to read.
Oh, that's great. I'm really interested in diving into this because I think there's a lot of different exciting species to read about. What points from your book do you think readers might find interesting to discuss?
I think the way we put the whole book together actually is a pretty interesting thing just to talk about from the very beginning. You know, we were originally approached by the publisher, which is Princeton, to write a book about the life of the ocean. And it just seemed a bit much. So we said, no, we can't write a book about the life of the ocean, but we could think about it and maybe put it together in a way that people would just instantly kind of gravitate to what was really amazing. And so the extreme life of the sea is the fastest things in the ocean, and the deepest, and the coldest, and the hottest, and the shallowest. And by putting them together like that, you bring out how strange the life of the ocean is, and how organisms there have to battle the elements in order just to stay alive in ways that we don't even really think of. And as a marine biologist, it's almost like, oh, all the secrets of marine biologists, all the things you know because you work in the ocean for a long, long, long time, we get to tell those stories. And they're fabulous stories about amazing creatures. And so we built the book around that as a way to entertain and inform, and then also to bring people a new appreciation for what lives in the sea.
Yeah, I agree that, I mean, the title of this book is very attention-grabbing, and then if you read the description, you realize how much you cover in the book. I mean, how many different areas within the ocean and all the different species that are in.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there are over 100 stories in the book, and they don't last for very long, a couple of pages each, but they're pulled together in a way that we tell, you know, how organisms have to fight with the drag that comes from moving fast in the water, or why is it really hard to live in the deep sea? It's dark and cold and there's hardly any food. So, and how do organisms adapt to that? So each story is pretty short. It delves into beluga whales and deep sea anglerfish and coral reefs. The stories bring out the traits that these critters have and brings them to life. And then we see them. We see how they live their lives, and then we kind of move on to the next topic.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, this book is so different from what we read in our online community already, so I think we'll really like tying up the season with something so different.
How is it different than what you usually read?
So this is very, nonfiction. Right now we're currently reading a book about the Mexican Revolution. And then next month we're reading Waiting for Godot. So it just kind of jumps around. But I think this is perfect for May. We're going to be moving right into summer after we're done. And I think we're really going to like it. So will you talk to us about your favorite part of the book and what meaning it has to you?
We've been all over the country giving book talks, hundreds of places, and sometimes this comes up, and I sort of struggle to think of what was my favorite. It often is like, well, what was I thinking of last? That's my favorite. But, you know, I just gave a course here at Stanford to a bunch of fabulous undergraduates, and it was the science of the extreme life of the sea. And it's all the science that was built into these stories. There's 700 references in this book, but they're, of course, just the background, and the stories use that science. And so that's actually one of the favorite things about it that for me is not any particular story, but the way the stories are told. They're factual, but the facts are just built into the story. You're there in the ocean and surrounded by these facts, like the way hydrothermal vents, which are 3,000 yards down in the ocean, bubble with sulfur and with heat, and the organisms that have to live there and how they deal with this incredible different environment, and the adaptations that they have to them. And so we build all those from the science that we have figured out over the last actually 10 or 20 years about these kinds of things. But it's not just a recitation of, okay, well, these organisms do that and that organism does this. It's built around interesting kind of questions. For example, when hydrothermal vents were discovered, it was 1974, and they were not discovered by biologists. They were discovered by geologists who were looking at the geology of how the tectonic plates of the ocean moved apart. They had no expectation that there'd be any life down there. They dropped the Alvin submarine down onto the first hydrothermal vent that they went to visit, and wham, there's this incredible life just burgeoning everywhere. They couldn't understand it. How could anything live down there? So this entire set of biology was born just by this amazing observation. And then very clever biologists quickly figured out how the tricks that these organisms use to live in such a bizarre, inhospitable environment. So those kinds of stories are built around the science, but then you get to actually kind of feel like you're there. What do these things look like? What are they doing? How are they different than you'd expect?
Oh, wow. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I was curious if you could share with us what your dive count is now, because I bet you've been diving quite a bit. And then did you do extra dives while writing this book?
You know, my dive count is in the thousands, but we didn't do any diving while writing this book. We did a lot of diving into the literature. And we have done a lot of field work around the book. So, for example, the extended ebook has 12 videos embedded in it. And some of them were filmed in the California Academy. Some I filmed right out in the Carmel Valley. I really wanted to show people how a fish moved at 40 miles an hour. Swordfish do. But I couldn't find any video of a fish going that fast. So we did our own video. I borrowed a stuffed marlin, and I put it on the roof of my car, and we drove it up and down the Carmel Valley Road at 40 miles an hour just to see what that was like. So we did some things like that, but it was mostly diving into these odd corners of the ocean, places that you just couldn't easily get to, and organisms that you couldn't just like snap your fingers and there they would be. One of the chapters is about the oldest critters in the ocean. How old do animals live in the ocean? And one of the things that were really very wrong about, 20, 30, 50 years ago was we just thought, critters in the sea lived a few years, 5, 10 years, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they don't. A lot of them live a lot longer. And so we delve into some of the ways that people have discovered that and what tools did they use to figure out that things were different than they thought. And one of the most amazing things was that 2014 was the 60th anniversary of something called Castle Bravo. And that was the first open-air hydrogen bomb explosion in Aniwetok Atoll in the Pacific. And so that was the first of a lot of atomic explosions. And our book is not about that. But what happened was that those explosions threw a radioactive isotope called C-14 into the atmosphere. It went all over the world, and it's in us, and it's in everything. But if you don't have it, you were born before that. And so people have been using the ear bones of fish and looking way back into the early lives of fish by going deep into their ear bones, of all things, and looking for carbon-14. And just that one little trick, invented by a guy named Greg Kaye, meant that all of a sudden we knew how old fish were. And some of them are a lot older than we would ever have imagined. 100 years, 150 years to grow a fish 2 feet long, that's a big deal.
Wow, that is fascinating.
Isn't it cool? I mean, there's just like the whole ocean is full of these things, these stories.
That's just one story too. Well, thank you so much for a great interview and introducing us to The Extreme Life of the Sea.
Well, I'm so thrilled that everyone is going to sit down and read it, and I'm very happy to chime in and have a discussion.
Great. Talk to you soon.